I'm Kevin Hatchard, and this is the Ultimate Sports Podcast. Coming up this week, we'll look back on an extraordinary performance from Dan Evans at the US Open Tennis. We'll also hear from John McEnroe on Serena Williams' bid to retain her crown. We'll review a Champions League draw that threw up some tricky groups for some and easier ones for others. We'll look ahead to two of the big matches in the Premier League weekend, and we'll also talk cricket. Have England made a mistake in resting some of their key players for the limited overs internationals against Australia? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by Russell Hargreaves.
Hi there, mate.
He's a touch sleep deprived due to his hectic working schedule, but he's gonna grit his teeth and get through this.
Wouldn't miss this one for the World Cup.
Russ, we'll start with tennis. Dan Evans has surprised everyone, really, by getting through to round three of the US Open Tennis. At time of recording, we don't know quite whether Laura Robson and Andy Murray have been able to do the same. But Dan Evans, an excellent win over Kei Nishikori in round one. And we all thought, well, that's probably it now. He's had his moment in the sun. But then he goes and repeats the trick against Bernard Tomic.
Yeah, really impressive stuff, Kev. I mean, the Tomic victory really was a little unexpected for a couple of reasons. As you say, first of all, beating Nishikori, the 11th seed, in emphatic fashion on the opening day or so at Flushing Meadow was absolutely fantastic stuff. And then the way he played against Tomic was remarkable because he obviously found himself a set down and a breakdown all within about 32 minutes and admitted it after the match. He looked up at the clock and thought, this is going to be messy. This could well be over. In about an hour and a bit, but his response was outstanding to take that set, to then take the next in a very important tiebreak. I think that was the definitive moment of the match, and then to wrap up the fourth set as well. Brilliant tennis. Next up, the 19th seed from Spain, Tommy Robredo. You know, on this form, he's got a chance, no question. After that, potentially the great man himself, Roger Federer, could await in round four, but we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. And just quickly, Kev, I think what's important for someone like Evans, still only 23, British player, historically do tend to mature a little later. Great talent. We can see that from his ground strokes, from his court coverage. Quite an infectious individual, quite nervous energy out on the court, and also somebody that's had issues previously with partying and not really being focused. He admitted he's quite a wild child. You can see that from the tattoos and the way he generally carries himself. So I think he's finally knuckled down, and because he's had a great US hard court season on the Challenger circuit, we're now starting to see just what he's capable of, and that new dedication to the sport coupled with confidence and his natural ability means we could have a player hopefully inside the top 100, if not even better, maybe to at least give Murray someone to really kind of push against and hopefully give some more momentum to British men's tennis.
Yes, nice to see a man flying the British flag in a Grand Slam tennis tournament that isn't Andy Murray for once. Well, defending ladies champion Serena Williams cruised into round three with a 6-2 6-love win over Galina Voskobueva. Williams has dropped just three games so far, but former US Open champion John McEnroe, who'll be playing at the Statoil Masters at the Royal Albert Hall in December, alongside the likes of Mark Filipoussis and Goran Ivanisevic, says she can't afford to get complacent.
When Serena goes into any event, she's head and shoulders above anyone if she's got her A game. As we all know, in sports, that doesn't always happen. And occasionally, no matter how great you are, you get knocked off if you're not playing your best.
With Sharapova out, obviously she pulled out before the tournament even started with a shoulder injury. Williams again looks the dominant force, doesn't she?
Yeah, I think Victoria Azarenka is her only realistic rival, I would say. You never know if someone's going to have a sensational tournament, a bit like obviously Bartoli and Lezicki did at Wimbledon this year. But I mean, it really is, Kev, only realistically Azarenka that's beaten her on a semi-consistent basis, yeah. Someone that can match her power. In an ideal world, one day, Laura Robson has got that kind of game that could match up against a Williams or an Azarenka because she is such a powerful hitter. I mean, Laura still, as we well know, has got an awful lot to evolve in her game yet, but she's still extremely young, by far the world's highest-ranked teenager. But that kind of style, I think, is what you need to try and take on Serena.
Let's switch our attention to football then, and fascinating Champions League draw. Manchester United will start with David Moyes embarking on his first Champions League group stage campaign. Obviously, with Everton, it didn't get that far.
No.
Manchester United drawn with Shakhtar Donetsk, Bayer Leverkusen and Real Sociedad. Some people would look at that and think, well, that's a fairly easy draw. But actually, Shakhtar have a decent record in this competition. Bayer Leverkusen under Sami Herpia are making decent strides. And Real Sociedad have surprised everybody over the past 12 months. So maybe not that straightforward.
No, I think it goes back to what you said at the start of our podcast, Kev, that some teams have got extremely difficult groups. Some have got relatively easy ones on paper. This probably falls somewhere in the middle for the reasons you've mentioned. So important for David Moyes, obviously, that he gets through that group. Huge Premier League games to come, interspersed with that as well. So a key early formative time for the Manchester United manager. And I think he'll look at that and be relatively happy. But I take your point about how each of those teams is its own potential banana skin.
Arsenal put in the group of death with Marseille, Napoli and last season's runners-up Borussia Dortmund. We know all about Dortmund and their progression under Jurgen Klopp over the past couple of seasons. Napoli under Rafa Benitez have spent big. They've lost Edinson Cavani, but they brought in the likes of Gonzalo Higuain. Dries Mertens has come in. Pepe Reina, the Liverpool goalkeeper. So they've made some really good signings. Marseille, arguably the weakest team in the group, but they're making strides towards the top of Ligue 1. So this is a difficult group for Arsenal. Do you think this now accelerates Arsene Wenger's transfer plans? Do you think he definitely needs to make big signings now?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that he made some quite strong media statements not long after all of that came out, just saying that the club do need to sort themselves out. And there is, I don't think he used the term disarray, but that's kind of the word that was being thrown at the situation. Yes, they've re-signed Mattia Flamini, who, of course, was excellent for Arsenal, particularly in Europe, 4 or 5 seasons ago, but they are well short. They've got Sinogo, the young striker, in, but you would feel, wouldn't you, that they're still at least 3 or 4 key players short, possibly an experienced goalkeeper to challenge Szczesny, definitely a defensive-minded midfielder, probably another striker and probably another centre-back for cover as well. So that's 4 positions I think that they need to sort out. It is a difficult group for me. I think the Celtic one is comparably tough. So the group of death tag is possibly a tie. But Arsenal's record of not just making the top 4 and qualifying from the Premier League, but also then getting out of their group is incredibly impressive. Year in, year out, they're written off. They struggle at times, but they often seem to get the job done and then fall, obviously, at a later hurdle. And I still have a feeling that's going to be the case.
Chelsea's group looks to be the most straightforward. They have Schalke, who have plenty of problems in the Bundesliga at the moment, Basel, the Swiss champions, and Steaua Bucharest. So you would expect Chelsea to get out of that one fairly comfortably. Manchester City, because of their low ranking in Europe, because
only themselves to blame,
from nowhere. They haven't managed to get out of the Champions League in each of the last 2 seasons because they've been given rock-hard groups. And again, not an easy group. The champions Bayern Munich, CSKA Moscow, who I believe are the Russian champions, and Viktoria Pilsen, who, you know, an unheralded name, but plenty of experience in the Champions League and the Europa League in recent seasons. It's not straightforward for Pellegrini's lot, is it?
It's not, Kev. You'd think they should possibly still finish second, particularly with all the money that's been spent. Let's not forget that. And I know CSKA Moscow have splashed out a fair bit themselves over time, and going to a cold and very, very testing Russia is going to be difficult. Obviously, those Bayern Munich games are going to be absolutely fantastic when you see all the stars that City have brought in against the Galacticos that Bayern have these days. So that's going to be an absolute cracker. I still think second place and City finally will get through. And as you touched on, that might be a bit of a snowball effect. If they do qualify for a knockout stages, their seeding improves and eventually they start to get their European plan together.
Well, Celtic, as Russell alluded to earlier on, the popular broadcaster Russell Hargreaves, who sadly passed away today.
Live during the Ultimate Sports podcast.
Well, Celtic, as Russell alluded to earlier on, perhaps not in the group of death, but the group of despair, because Neil Lennon put his head in his hands when he realised what he'd been faced with. They beat Barcelona in last season's competition. They'll have to do so again to get out of the group stage, you would think. They've also got Ajax and AC Milan. We didn't expect them to get out of their group last season and they did it. Can you see a repeat this time?
I mean, Milan potentially might be a little bit hit and miss, mightn't they, this season? I don't know. I suppose perhaps Neil Lennon will be hoping that Ajax sell the likes of Christian Eriksen and one or two of their other top young performers, be it by their Dutch contingent or their Danes, of which they have many at the moment. But really difficult group. And obviously, you know, to have such teams of such high quality in there is incredibly unlucky. Barca, you feel, are not going to probably see lightning being striked twice and lose to Celtic again. So, unfortunately, I fear the head-in-hand response was probably quite befitting.
Two games to look forward to in the Premier League that we've picked out. It really is a super Sunday. Liverpool against Manchester United. Liverpool have started the campaign with two wins out of two. Manchester United, of course, were held to a goalless draw by Chelsea on Monday after that highly impressive win away to Swansea. This is a fascinating game. It's always a very intriguing clash when these two Northwest rivals do battle. But Liverpool will fancy their chances going into this, if only because they've started the season so well.
Yeah, exactly. I think this could be an absolute cracker. And I'm impressed with what Liverpool have managed to achieve, Kev. And obviously, they're still without Luis Suarez, but we've seen Daniel Sturridge really step up to the mark. And as we know, there are a couple of other players, aren't there, in that squad these days, Coutinho chief among them, who have been very impressive. Defensively, they're not looking too bad, are they? I know Colo Touré has picked up a knock, I think.
Yeah, Touré's got a groin injury, so he might miss out.
At the back, they may be a little short of cover, but I'm sure the first choice back four will still be fairly strong. And for me, I'd just like to sort of give a quick shout out to someone like Jordan Henderson, who I think has been playing quite well this season and scored a belting goal, of course, the other day. And one of few players from those Kenny Dalglish wasted £100 million that maybe still has got a chance to actually deliver the goods and live up to their potential that he showed in Sunderland. So good on him. I wonder if one or two of those players is something to prove, added to a few of the more stable bedrocks of the squad and a few new faces, might just gel and maybe get it done for Brendan Rodgers. That said, I think in terms of this match, maybe 2-2 might be a decent prediction, but we'll see, because United is still full of match winners, chief among them Robin van Persie.
United drew that game against Chelsea on Monday, and I thought Chelsea looked quite good, actually, and looked quite comfortable in spells at Old Trafford. If they were to win this game, is that the marquee win that Moyes needs just to convince everyone he's the right man for the job?
I don't think it quite gets him there, Kev, but it certainly wouldn't hurt. I think it would be a really good way to continue to build on the momentum of what's been an okay start. If they were to lose, then hopefully there won't be too many sort of whisperers and dissenters at this stage, but it's not going to strengthen his cause. And also, just quickly, with the transfer window shutting, big wins may just help convince one or two people as the clock ticks down to come. And were they to lose that, maybe the odd player around Europe, around the world, who'd be thinking about joining might be thinking, well, is this guy going to be in a job in 2 or 3 months' time? Could I end up coming and being a bit of a dead man walking?
We've talked about Arsenal's lack of transfer activity. You certainly couldn't level that accusation at Spurs.
Yeah, they've signed a couple of players, apparently.
They've signed a lot of players. They've brought in Eric Lamela from Roma, who's a very, very good attacking midfielder. They're also talking to Christian Eriksen, who you mentioned earlier on, the Ajax midfielder. So getting good players in. They've already signed plenty of top players.
Yeah, there's a lad from Romania that's just joined the defender
as
well.
Yes, Vlad Kirikes, who's a good, solid defender, strong, good in the air. Saw him in the Europa League last season for Stau. Was very impressed with him, so there's some cover there as well. Even though they're going to lose Gareth Bale to Real Madrid, I think they look better now without Bale and with all those players than they did relying on him last season.
Yeah, they're an excellent squad, aren't they? I saw them a couple of weeks ago in their opener against Crystal Palace, where they weren't great but still got the job done. I think Soldado is a wonderful signing. Potentially another top-class striker might yet be an option. I don't know. But that said, Jermaine Defoe looked fairly sharp in the Europa League qualifier in midweek as well,
really,
didn't he?
Good.
So
yeah,
things are looking very good for them. I still have a funny feeling, though, that Arsenal are going to be OK. Whether it's a case of bringing in those marquee players, to use the term you mentioned with David Moyes, or whether it's a case of really building with what is a decent squad, if a bit of a small squad. I like the fact that Wenger cut some dead wood and got rid of 7 or 8 players who weren't really going to feature and were on high wages. Good decision, but he probably needs to bring in the right 2 or 3 players around that. The papers are full of speculation about players from Real Madrid, from Saint-Etienne, you name it, around Europe that he's keen on. It's all well and good being keen on them. He's got to start signing them. And the fact he's still struggling and the board are still struggling, you contrast that with Spurs, who basically seem to be able to sign, Willian aside, almost anyone they want.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a contrast there, which a lot of people are struggling to get their head around.
Well, we'll finish up with cricket this week. And England made a losing start to their limited overs campaign against Australia. They lost the first T20 match in Southampton by 39 runs after a world record display from Aaron Finch, the Aussie batsman, who made 156, a world record. And England have been criticised for dropping some of their, or resting rather, some of their key players. This is the response to that from the T20 captain, Stuart Broad.
You need to have a big group of players going into that World Cup with experience of international caps. And they wouldn't be in the squad if they're not good enough to play. And that ODI squad will be very focused on beating Australia.
Is he right about that, or have England missed a trick in not maintaining the momentum from the Ashes?
I think they've gone a bit too far with how many players they've dropped. I personally would have liked to have seen Ian Bell kept in the team, just chiefly because, obviously, in terms of one-day cricket, Kev, he lost his place in the one-day side for quite a while not that long ago, when his age-old problem of getting off to a start and then maybe looking well set and getting out for 30-odd was continuing to frustrate. He came back into the one-day squad, of course, a few months ago, did pretty well against New Zealand in a series I covered earlier this summer. Obviously, his test form has been absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And I'd just like to have seen him continue and build his one-day confidence. So he's one I would have loved to have seen. I'm covering this series coming up as well. And yeah, it's just a little bit of a shame, isn't it, that there are two or three players you would have liked to have seen. I appreciate how two or three of them are in need of a rest. The others, I wonder if they've taken it a bit too far. And that's opened the whole can of worms, hasn't it? As Michael Vaughan has said about fans who pay big money in advance for tickets to get their seat secured for this series. And then they get there and find that it is kind of a half Lions, half emerging players with a few top stars thrown in kind of approach. And that is disappointing. Just going back to your other point about Finch, what a knock. I mean, 26 years old, Victorian, only seven T20 internationals for Australia. So he's not exactly had a long international career, but what a knock. I know in T20 you can get in and suddenly just blitz the opposition, and that clearly happened. It may not be representative necessarily of what he'll do moving forward. I think players like Kevin O'Brien for Ireland are good examples of that. A couple of good knocks, and then they appear like a bit of a busted flush afterwards. But brilliant to see. Various records went. Didn't quite get the 175, which is the highest first-class T20 knock, which I think Chris Gayle still owns.
Yeah.
But yeah, wonderful knock. 14 sixes, 11 fours. It was brilliant to see. Concerns for a couple of the England bowlers, but well done him. And the Aussies well set heading into the second match of that series with the five one-day internationals to come, all starting next weekend. So bring it on.
And just finally on this, Russell, I guess there are two schools of thought, aren't there? You either take the Stuart Broad view that they're widening the pool of players they can call upon when it comes to global tournaments. But one of the things that struck me about England's success at test level is clarity of selection. They know they have a group of 15, 16, 17 players, and that's pretty much it. And they can bring in a guy like Joe Root every so often, or Johnny Bairstow every so often. But the core of the team is there. Is there a worry that if you give too many people caps, there's no clarity of selection and it's a bit of a jumble?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point, Kev, because you look at all the players that either in T20 or 50-over cricket that have been thrown in and out. You know, players like Michael Lum periodically appear, then disappear again, don't they? And, you know, Boyd Rankin is in at the moment for his opportunity, potentially. You've got someone like Gary Balance, who was excellent for the Lions, fully deserves his chance, but will that be a little bit diluted by some of these other guys coming in and out? Someone like Jade Dernbach, 1 minute, is out, then he's in. To his credit, he actually played very well in that game we've just been talking about for once, but has disappointed an awful lot before that. Yes, I just think there is a little bit of a murky picture and probably too many names floating around, and it would be good to maybe have about 18, say, 50-over cricketers that England choose from. At the moment, their pool is 20-odd, and it would be better to probably have a few less who are playing more consistently to give their game plan and their approach a little bit more structure.
Well, that's it for this week from Russell Hargreaves and myself, Kevin Hatchard. It's goodbye for now.
And stay safe.